This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Florida lawmakers closed the state's 2026 regular legislative session last Friday, but without the traditional hanky drop and the usual celebratory pomp and circumstance. Session ended without lawmakers doing the one thing they're constitutionally required to do, which is pass a budget. The House and Senate's proposed spending plans remain around $1.4 billion apart. House Speaker Daniel Perez and Senate President Ben Albritton have agreed to return in mid-April to finish the spending plan, but haven't agreed on much else, including top-line spending numbers, which would be the first step before formal negotiations between the chambers can begin. Several bills considered priority legislation also failed to pass, including Governor Ron DeSantis's push for an AI Bill of Rights, Senate President Albritton's Rural Renaissance Package, and a medical freedom bill that would have created more ways for parents to opt their children out of school vaccine mandates. Lawmakers also failed to pass legislation addressing DeSantis's priority of reducing or eliminating homestead property taxes. Significant bills that did pass include a measure requiring verification of U.S. citizenship for voters that restrict some forms of ID for voting, and a bill that aims to ban local governments from funding or promoting anything related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Ahead of the first of what could become several special legislative sessions beginning next month, today I'm joined virtually by political scientist and assistant director of the University of Central Florida School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs, Aubrey Jewett. Welcome back, Dr. Jewett.
Thanks for having me on.
And I'm joined in studio by Florida Gulf Coast University political science professor Sandra Pavelka. She's the founding director of the Institute for Youth and Justice Studies at FGCU, and she's co-authored the forthcoming book, The Power of Her, Women Shaping Politics and Society, which we'll be discussing in a future episode of this program. Dr. Pavelka, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, of course, John. Thank you for having me.
And to engage with us and your fellow listeners about this conversation or any of our shows, find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. On X, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So priority legislation not passing, Republican infighting, the budget not getting done on time. Are you guys experiencing the same sense of deja vu that I am? Dr. Pavelka, I'll start with you.
It's deja vu all over again. We experienced this last session last year, and it seems like we're back where we were before. And of course, as we've spoken about before, this is a state constitutional mandate that requires the balanced budget to be passed within session. And we're looking at a special session which will cost even more money to bring back legislators and their aides and so forth. So there are many programs and services across the state that are really relying on this budget, and without it, we're nowhere. So, and if in fact they don't pass a budget by July 1, we could indeed see a time where, you know, we've experienced it with the federal government, we'll see it with the state, where we'd actually not have a budget and be having, you know, shortfalls and experience shortfalls all over again. So,
Dr. Jewett, I don't want to sound alarmist. I mean, Dr. Pavelka is absolutely correct. That is technically what would happen if we hit July 1st, the start of the next fiscal year. But do you think it's likely that could happen? I mean, we still have a lot of time before July 1st.
I don't think it's likely. And in fact, even last year, you know, it came right up to the last day or two and they finally got over the finish line. And historically, Florida hasn't really had a shutdown like we've seen at the national level. And also, if you look, on the one hand, you know, the difference between what the House has proposed and the Senate proposed, it's a little over $1 billion, which, of course, you know, that's a lot of money on one hand. But on the other hand, considering that one side's saying they want like $115 billion and the other side saying they want like $113.6 billion, $1 billion is less than 1% of the difference, right, of what they've got. So it seems to me that it wouldn't take an expert in compromise in mediation to sort of say, look, you come up $700 million and you come down $700 million and we meet in the middle and there you go. So The thought is that they ought to be able to get a compromise on this. So really, again, $1 billion is a lot of money, but by a percent, I mean, it's like 1% difference. Right. between what they've offered at the beginning. That's not that far apart.
Yeah, totally agree, Aubrey. I think that you know, they at this point there's it's minor in the grand scheme of things, right?
Well, and you know, at the end of the day, you know, if a budget is proposed before July 1st, Governor DeSantis will still have his, you know, veto power. But in terms of the actual negotiations, does he play a role? I mean, maybe not literally, but in terms of influence. I know that DeSantis had pledged to veto the budget and call lawmakers back again if they ended up passing a budget that included cuts to Everglades restoration projects like some House leaders had been pushing for. And as we all know, Everglades restoration, water resource protection funding, that's been a signature issue for him literally since day one of his administration.
It would be unusual for the governor to veto the entire budget. That just doesn't really happen, but mainly because they do have the line item veto, and so they can cut all sorts of lines of objectionable spending without having to do the whole budget. Yeah. But if they did, you know, if they sort of expressly went against what the governor had as priorities, it's certainly possible he could. It's very conflictual up there, and particularly between the House Speaker and the governor, there seems to be some really ill feelings, like on a personal level, beyond just the professional checks and balances. So I'll say at this point, nothing would shock me.
Okay.
Well, and certainly the governor has used his line item veto powers in the past, and I would obviously think that moving into this next special session for the budget, that he will have his red pen out and ready for any vetoes he wants to make.
Sure. Well, let's talk about some of the high profile bills that did not pass and that are, you know, effectively dead for this year. First, Senate President Albritton's priority, that rural renaissance package. And again, this is, I think, the second consecutive year that passed the Senate but didn't really go anywhere in the House. What do you think happened here? Can we just chalk this up to Republican infighting?
Well, this was really interesting because this was looked at as his legacy legislation. He fought for this for several years. I think, you know, obviously he came very close last year. The Senate supported it, went to the House. The House really, it didn't go anywhere. And the same thing happened again this year, where last time we were on, actually a few weeks ago, the Senate had just passed it overwhelmingly, and it went to the House and went nowhere. But this is what we're seeing really this session, with so many bills where each chamber is at odds in supporting one thing over another, and it's really been conflictual. And, you know, if we look at the dynamics, this is a Republican-led state government. We have both houses that are Republican and our governor. So we really shouldn't be seeing this, but we are.
Right. There aren't enough Democrats elected in either chamber to really determine whether or not something passes or fails.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, another example of a measure that passed the Senate but stalled in the House was Governor DeSantis's priority of an AI Bill of Rights. This would have extended parental control of, you know, parents, you know, use of AI, required more transparency so people know when they're interacting with AI, added some data privacy protections, even imposed some remedies for AI misuse of someone's name, image, or likeness without their consent. Again, more collateral damage stemming from that GOP infighting of the legislature? Or is there something more going on with this bill in particular, just in terms of ideologically how we should be regulating artificial intelligence? Dr. Jewett?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's a little of both. Like many of the bills that got bogged down, some of it is just because, I won't say dysfunction, but because of the disagreements between the executive branch and the legislature, and particularly between the House and the governor, but even the House and Senate have not been getting along real well. But having said that, there is a real legitimate argument about who should be regulating AI. And President Trump has said that he thinks the national government should do it. And that is the position that the Speaker of the House, Daniel Perez, that's what he said. He said, look, I agree. This artificial intelligence is the new technology, and we need to make sure that we have sufficient rules and regulations. But I don't think it should be each state doing their own thing. Instead, then we should wait for the national government. And because Trump's on his side, that gives him, amongst Republicans, that gives Speaker Perez some, you know, some gravitas, right? That's, it's not just, oh, you're just being stubborn. Instead, he's sort of saying, you know, theoretically, this is a better idea to have the national government do it, so we don't have all these different rules that the companies have to follow. And plus, you know, our party leader, President Trump, says he wants to do it that way. So that has not that he necessarily needed more ammo to dig in his heels and say, I'm not going to do what the governor wants. But in this case, he does have that. So.
Yeah. You know, perhaps the most high profile issue where we didn't see legislation pass concerns reducing or eliminating homestead property taxes. The House did pass a measure that, again, if approved by voters in November, would incrementally reduce non-school homestead property taxes over a 10-year period until they're eliminated. Given how hard the governor has been pushing for this for more than a year now, did that surprise you that we didn't see something come out of the regular session on this?
Well, nothing surprised me this session.
Gotcha.
It was kind of like, the deja vu all over again. But, seriously, the governor has been pushing this, like you said, John. And I mean, we really, especially, you know, the students and those researchers like myself who are, and Aubrey, who are, you know, we study this stuff. And the fact that it really didn't move and that we may see another special session because of it is really troubling. But in all seriousness, the local governments are relying on this money. And if the state government actually passes some type of legislation that's going to restrict that funding, even though it does have to go to the voters for a supermajority vote, but they're still relying on that money. So we have to see that money come to the state, or excuse me, to the local governments and county governments somehow. Is that going to be through fees or assessments? So I think that the local governments are you know, vying a position to really also monitor this because all of their lobbying really has. I don't want to say go nowhere because it has gone somewhere. Obviously, it's stifled at the state level. But, you know, we really need to see some action one way or the other so the local governments can actually plan for their funding.
Dr. Jewett, do you have any idea if they do decide to bring the property tax elimination, you know, effort back up, if they might do it in this special session on the budget, or if they would then call maybe a third special session after the one we know that's going to start April 20th on redistricting?
Well, Governor DeSantis seems to really like calling special sessions, so perhaps they will just keep calling one after another different ones. But theoretically, they could bring up several things in a special session, right? The budget, the property tax thing, and Governor DeSantis said there's one or two other things he'd like to, you know, have them revisit that they didn't pass the first time. I do think one of the interesting aspects of this is that although Governor DeSantis was the one that launched this discussion into the public sphere, you know, apparently it was online and somebody said something offhand about cutting the, you know, property taxes, and then it just sort of took a life of its own. So Governor DeSantis has talked about this, but he's never actually come up with a detailed plan that he's presented to the legislature. I mean, it's been a year and he hasn't done it. And I will say Speaker Perez, whether you agree with, you know, cutting property taxes or not, he actually took it seriously. And they had a committee and they came up with like 8 or 10 suggestions, and then they narrowed it down. Then they decided, here's the one. Senate really hasn't done anything. The governor hasn't done anything. So it does kind of make you wonder what's going on in the governor's head. Why hasn't he done this? And one of the reasons is because no matter what you propose, it's probably not going to be quite as good as what originally he promised, which was, we're going to get rid of all property taxes.
Yeah,
because we just financially, the average Floridian just wouldn't want to see that happen because you have to get needed services provided by it.
Yeah.
And then two is if he actually comes up with detailed plans, then it immediately opens it up, you know, to criticism and attack. So for whatever reason, he has not taken that step. And that's really delayed it quite a bit, I think.
Well, and Dr. Jewett, on top of not coming up or releasing his own plan, the governor actually vetoed money from the current fiscal year budget that was allocated for the Florida Office of Economic and Demographic Research to actually research what the potential impacts of reducing or eliminating property taxes would be. That office was still charged with doing that study, and to my knowledge, we've never seen the results. Yeah. Does that kind of give you pause about how this might go forward, even if something does end up on the statewide ballot in November?
It does, because the thought is, on average, people don't like to pay taxes in America. We can go back to 1776, right? That was theoretically, that's what the revolution was about, you know, no taxation without representation. So if you put something before voters and just sort of say, oh, no, yeah, let's reduce taxes or eliminate taxes, there is a propensity for voters to say yes. But there is no such a thing as a free lunch. And conservative Republicans traditionally have also known that, say, look, you have to pay for things that you want. We do want to keep taxes low, so let's keep government slim. But there was this recognition that it really does take money to provide services. And when you see things like what the governor has done of defunding the agency that would actually take a hard look at how cutting property taxes would impact local government service delivery, it makes you wonder, A, if he's real serious, or B, maybe he's serious about getting it through with the thought of, if we just keep focusing on the cutting the taxes without people feeling that there's going to be any pain, we can get this through and I'll have another feather in my cap when I run for president in 2028.
Gotcha.
But we also have to be reminded that Florida is a very low tax state. We
already
have no state income tax already. We have, you know, relatively low sales tax. And I mean, we make our money off of Disney and, you know, the theme
tourism
parks.
Dollars,
and,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, we really have to be sensitive to this. And I mean, while cutting taxes is a great thing, I'm all for it, but we also have to fund those services and know that we're already, you know, in one of the lowest tax states in the country.
Well, Dr. Pavelka, I wanted to talk about some legislation that did pass, and I'll start with you on at least this one bright spot of bipartisanship concerning a bill addressing domestic violence.
Yes, this was actually very impactful, and this was a bipartisan bill that passed both the House and the Senate. It was a House Bill 277. It strengthened penalties for domestic violence offenders, and especially for repeat offenders. And it also improved support programs for victims and survivors, which is so important. They're already struggling, and so this provided funding for those specific programs.
All right. And another bill that did pass kind of just under the wire is a voter ID bill sponsored by Fort Myers own Republican Representative Jenna Persons Mullica. This is going to require proof of U.S. citizenship for voter registration using documents like a passport, birth certificate, naturalization papers, etc. Creates procedures to verify citizenship status through a statewide voter registration system. And it eliminates what in the past have been considered acceptable forms of photo ID at the polls, like a neighborhood association card, or for college students, a student ID. Supporters say this will help ensure election integrity. Critics say this is a solution looking for a problem. What do you think the result of this is going to be? Dr. Pavelka, do you think we're going to see more folks facing challenges casting legitimate ballots in the past that they haven't?
Well, we haven't really had a problem with that in the past here in Florida. And I know there, you know, there's radar out there that is monitoring this. But I think really we may see a negative impact with regard to voter turnout. We already have kind of a low voter turnout, if you would, in local elections. You know, we're lucky if we get 20-30% of voters out. And obviously, you know, 60-70% during presidential. But this could negatively affect voter turnout, especially when marginalized individuals are at stake in terms of their voting, and they may not have those real IDs that are available and won't be able to produce that come election day.
And those aren't necessarily free to get. Also,
exactly.
It's interesting. Federal Highway Administration data shows that in the early 80s, about 80% of 18-year-olds in the U.S. had driver's licenses. By 2022, that percentage had dropped to 59%. I wasn't aware that young people weren't getting driver's license the way
that
we
either.
Did.
Right.
So
that was the first thing we wanted to do when we
Right, right. But it's a different world now. Mm-hmm. And if that's not an acceptable form of ID at the polls, is this perhaps going to, you know, adversely impact younger voters in particular?
Yeah, absolutely could. I mean, we could see this, you know, really all around. And it's not necessarily a good thing because we want voters. We want people to turn out in the polls. And if they don't have these IDs that are being required, they're not going to they're not registered to vote and they won't be showing up at the polls.
Yeah. Another high profile bill that did pass kind of just before the finish line bans local governments from funding or promoting really anything related to diversity, equity and inclusion. I guess what is the goal here and what concerns have critics of this legislation brought up? Dr. Jewett?
Well, I think broadly the goal is for conservative Republicans to continue their war on woke. And so politically they think it's a good thing for them because they feel like their base responds to it. And of course they've seen over the last 5 years Republicans take a big lead in voter registration in Florida and turn Florida into a red state. I don't know that it was necessarily just because of that, but that's one of the things that they have been pushing. So I think politically, that's one of the reasons. You know, in terms of the impact, I think that in some ways it's like taking a chainsaw to something that just needs a scalpel, right? That there's probably a few very specific things that some cities and counties have done or funded or are using for educational purposes that many social conservative Republicans wouldn't like. But instead, they've passed something that seems to be pretty broad. And for instance, the little city I live in called Oviedo, which is a sort of a suburban city outside Orlando, I just went to their St. Patrick's Day celebration on Saturday evening with my family, and it was a fun time. But there's a lot of people that think programs like that will no longer be allowed because it's like it's Irish, it's diversity, it's included. You know,
right.
Could you not do any of those kinds of things anymore?
Well, hypothetically, and that could apply to Oktoberfest, Easter celebrations. I mean,
absolutely.
There could be unintended consequences.
All sorts of holidays that might be themed to a particular belief or a particular ethnicity or culture might now be suspect. And because they have made these penalties pretty draconian, that, you know, specifically if you do these things, it will be considered misfeasance or malfeasance, which are two of the reasons why a governor can suspend a local official. And of course, they've also allowed local people to sue on that as well. So it really probably will make local governments very reluctant to continue to fund even things that the vast majority of residents enjoy and like. And
there's also a provision in there that allows residents to sue municipalities, like you mentioned, and enables the governor to remove officials who violate that law.
Yeah. Does this seem destined for, you know, court challenges? Because, you know, I've also heard critics voicing concerns about the overly broad language in terms of whether or not this would even comply with federal laws concerning things like compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, anti-discrimination laws like Title IX and Title VII.
This absolutely could show up I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't show up in the courts in terms of, you know, one organization suing the other and the government and so forth.
And another controversial measure that did pass concerns Florida's Emergency Preparedness Response Fund. The fund actually expired during the session that just ended amid disputes between the House and Senate, but they did pass a measure to reauthorize it in the final days of session. And this fund has widely been known in the past in helping address crises like hurricanes, other natural disasters. Dr. Jewett, why has it become more controversial?
Well, it's become controversial because Governor DeSantis has used it for several years in a row now to fund policy priorities that some people might not think were emergencies. He basically declared an illegal immigration emergency about 3 years ago, and then he keeps re-upping it over and over and over again. And so this money, hundreds of millions of dollars, in fact, has been used with very little oversight and very little specific legislative approval. And so there was some thought that the legislature was really going to put the, you know, the clamps on this. The bill they passed, from my understanding, does provide a little bit of oversight, but not nearly as much as some of the legislators were arguing for in the first place. Basically, in the end, I think they, on two things. One, even though DeSantis is a lame duck and he's on his way out, I think they didn't want to completely cross him. And two, they didn't want to be accused of being tight with money for emergencies. Like, let's say it's an emergency that everybody agrees on, like a hurricane. They wanted to make sure that there was money and funding available. So in the end, they did put a few regulations about oversight, but it wasn't as tough as some people were talking about originally.
And for years now in Florida, we've seen lawmakers taking steps that have, been kind of moving state resources away from public education in K through 12 schools and more towards charter and private school operators. Dr. Pavelka, what did we see come out of session as it relates to that issue?
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, because now we're seeing this bill that just passed both the House and the Senate. Would expand charter schools and school choice policies. So an expansion of charter school opportunities and school choice options, and allowing new charter programs and really a broad participation in school choice initiatives, which would really deter and keep much needed funding in the public schools away from them. So.
Right. Yeah. And Dr. Jewett, we've got just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to give you the final word, because I know you've done some calculations on what it costs Florida taxpayers when lawmakers can't finish their work on time and end up going into these special sessions.
Yeah, well, it does cost money. I was asked by another media outlet, is it do they get paid more? Because there was some concern that maybe they're intentionally, going into special session because they get more money in their salary or something. I assured them, no, that's not the case. They actually don't get very much money. Their salary is about $30,000 a year, whether you're a House member or a senator, and it doesn't change if you go into special session. But where you do incur costs from the taxpayer standpoint is that you have to pay for people to travel back and forth to Tallahassee. And then once you're up there, you have to reimburse them for their food and their living expenses, like for hotel or condo or whatever they might rent. And so if you start adding that up, it might be $100, $150, $200 a day. And then it's 120 members in the House, 40 members in the Senate, is 160 people. And then they each have at least one staffer, and usually the senators bring two. So at least maybe 320 people by, 120, 150, 200 a day. Bottom line is $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, for a special session. It does add up, especially the longer it goes.
Now, when you're talking about, putting together a huge, $100 million or billion-dollar budget, that's not a lot of money. But considering Floridians consistently show in public opinion polls that affordability issues, especially the rising cost of living, is their number one priority, it's the optics of numbers like that that can make a difference.
It is. It's politically tone deaf. As you point out, it's, in terms of the actual budget, it's a pretty small percent. But in terms of, especially going back to do the budget, when that's the one thing you have to do constitutionally, I think a lot of Floridians sort of get frustrated. It's one thing if there is an emergency that happens between sessions and the legislature has to go back up, the public sort of understands, hey, this is the way the system works. But just to not fulfill your constitutional responsibility and then cause taxpayers $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, that I think rubs a lot of taxpayers the wrong way.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank my guests. I've been speaking with University of Central Florida political scientist Dr. Aubrey Jewett. Dr. Jewett, thanks so much. Your insights are always appreciated.
Thanks for having me on.
And also thanks to FGCU political science professor Dr. Sandra Pavelka. Always good to hear from you as well.
Thanks, John.
And if you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, Emma Gonzalez, and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers. Bears 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, and PR for Southwest Florida.